Chapter 2. Failed Rage, Positive Thinkers, Anger Managers, Protesters. When anger is captured wholesale by aggression, the two are liable to become confused, as though anger were merely the accompanying mood music to acts of violence and destruction. As Chapter 1 showed us, angry feelings are often experienced as the cheerleaders for aggressive action, a rowdy internal crowd rallying the team to attack the opponent. But anger is only rarely so tightly in league with aggression. More often, we try to keep them apart. Who isn't familiar with that smart of offended justice, pride, or fairness, which, in the absence of a ready outlet, simply churns in the gut? Most of us are liable to swallow anger more often than we act on it to prevent aggression from having its way. I'm recalling myself at 15, bespectacled and slight, being greeted by the same daily insult from a massive, gurning bully as I entered the classroom for maths. "Ah, it's Cohen," except it was pronounced as Hoeen, on the understanding shared by his gormlessly chortling sidekicks that this sounded Jewish, especially when accompanied by the sliding of his index finger down the bridge of his nose and beyond, miming the grotesque elongation of mine, which, for what it's worth, was and remains exaggeratedly small, usually to the tune of "If I Were a Rich Man." I remained silent each time, trying to convey contempt rather than fear. I'd stare past the chalky equations and triangles for the next 45 minutes, teeth grinding and blood rising as I composed endless comebacks, each more venomous than the next. "Do you even have a nose, Pete?" I'd imagine asking him nonchalantly. "It's hard to tell under those layers of pustular disease." On occasion, I enhanced the scene with a pretty girl glancing at him and giggling on cue, perhaps absently touching her slender fingers to the tip of my shoulder. At other times, my comeback was eloquently wordless. A punch, so devastating it would drive his nose back into his skull, opening a vacuum in the middle of his face. "Anyone else?" I would calmly ask his stunned, cowering friends. "Thought not," I'd conclude, languidly shaking out my right hand. Nasty? Vicious? Vindictive? Indeed. Anger is never so ugly as when it's denied an outlet. I felt the force of my murderous aggression in these moments, but no one else did. My sadistic impulses were diverted from my coiled fist to my brooding mind, from the realm of action to the realm of fantasy, where they simmered impotently at the highest temperature. These episodes come to mind when I return to Freud and Breuer's brief account of the beaten employee, the man who consulted Freud about hysterical attacks, which, under hypnosis, were revealed as performances of the frenzied rage he felt as his boss publicly beat him with a stick. Anger here is an unbearable accretion of tension denied an outlet in the external world, forced to remain bottlenecked inside the tight spaces of the mind and body. I feel like I know something of this man's predicament, of how it feels to be provoked into a response that is immediately blocked. When the aggressive drive is aroused, it presses for action in the external world. But when the path to action is obstructed, the drive is subjected to all manner of displacements, reversals, and detours. Diverted from its aim of intervening in reality, say retaliating against a sadistic boss or bully, it has to find somewhere else to go, some new form to assume. So an impulse that begins life as an intention to act morphs into a heightened feeling state. We might recall here Darwin's idea that emotional expression is a vestige of action, such as when we clench our teeth and turn red or white in the face of the act of fighting an enemy. Feelings may seem like a prelude and guide to action, as when we say we acted on our feelings, but in this account, we feel because we act and not the other way around. We start with preparatory gestures of action. Only evolution has repressed the impulse to bite, socializing us into a more pacific stance. The bite stays inside, morphing from an action into a feeling. I never punched Pete, but my nostrils flared, my blood ran hot, and my fists and teeth clenched, as though in suspended readiness to strike. Then my impulse to aggression met the obstacle of my anxiety of self-preservation, rendering me all feeling, no action. Like the employee, I could enjoy neither the immediate pleasure of retaliation nor the delayed satisfaction of justice. Instead, I carried my load of rage like the mariner his albatross. What other feeling works in this way? It makes little sense to think of either joy or sadness as being frustrated. Frustration or dissatisfaction is what occurs when a wish or a desire is left unfulfilled. But neither joy nor sadness desires or aims towards anything. Joy, of course, is its own end by definition. If it involved a wish or a demand for something more, it would cease to be a joy. Sadness is more complicated, in that the sad person does wish for something, namely whatever would bring their sadness to an end. A permanent summer holiday, say, or the return of a lost love. But if we had the power to prolong summer indefinitely, or bring back those we have lost, we couldn't be said to have satisfied our sadness, only to have brought it to an end. Of all the emotions, it is only anger and love that are defined by their perpetual liability to dissatisfaction. In anger and love, we are forever wanting things and failing to get them. It's no coincidence that these emotions correlate with aggression and sexuality. Aggressive action and sexual union are the respective means by which anger and love seek fulfillment in the external world. Human beings, moreover, are able to send these protean forces down innumerable different paths, enlisting them as much for self-destruction as for self-preservation, for death as for life, for stasis as for growth. But as more or less every human being knows, such attempts at fulfillment often fail. Neither aggressive action nor sexual union is guaranteed to satiate our rage or desire. Both can be disappointing, deflating, anticlimactic, as though failing to provide what they seem to promise. Freud suggests that there is something in the nature of the sexual drive that doesn't permit full satisfaction. The object of the drive is forever elusive, slipping out of our fingers the moment we think we possess it. The same is strangely true of the aggressive drive. In his harrowing memoir of his years imprisoned in Dachau concentration camp, the French writer Robert Atelme portrays the SS as possessed by a rage to eliminate the humanity of the victims they beat and killed. But in doing so, they ran up against the limits of their own power to destroy. It's because we're men like them that the SS will finally prove powerless before us, he writes. You can kill a person, in other words, but you cannot banish them from the human race. Even at its furthest edge, the drive to dominate and destroy can never fulfill itself completely. In its early history, psychoanalysis tended to be far more interested in the drives than in feelings, in sexuality rather than love, in aggression rather than anger. But between the 1930s and 1980s, the tide turned, and psychoanalysis developed the new theory of object relations in the work of key figures such as Ronald Fairbairn, D.W. Winnicott, Marion Milner, and later on, Christopher Bolas. It became more interested in emotional relationships and abandoned the theory of drives on the grounds that it was too mechanistic and insufficiently attuned to human feeling. But this is to assume, mistakenly, that feelings and drives are opposed to one another. On the contrary, they are intimate companions. I would go so far as to say that drives are central to understanding why we have feelings. One key reason for this misunderstanding of the concept of the drive is that James Strachey, Freud's English translator, rendered the original German word Trieb as instinct rather than drive. Strachey saw this as a pragmatic solution to the absence of an adjectival form of drive, which created all kinds of translational problems. After all, he argued, doesn't instinct mean more or less the same thing? In fact, it doesn't. And while this might seem like a pedantic theoretical objection, the distinction between drive and instinct has significant implications for how we understand who and what we are as human beings. As we saw in the introduction, an instinct is a piece of inbuilt biological knowledge that ensures the attainment of our vital needs, as when a bee gravitates towards nectar. A drive contains this instinctual component, but it also complicates it. A baby may, by instinct, seek the nutritive satisfaction of her mother's milk when she feeds off the breast, but she is also seeking the more sensually and emotionally charged pleasures of the milk's warmth, the breast's yielding softness against her cheek, the nipple's reassuringly tensile resistance against her tongue. If we were reducible to biological instincts, if our sexuality, for example, was nothing more than a wish to discharge libidinal energy, or even to reproduce the species, What we call love could be conveniently satisfied by the odd bout of efficient rutting. But because drives rather than instincts are what animate us, we are destined always to want something more, to feel some nagging sense of lacking what we most desire, and to yearn for that ultimate fulfillment we never achieve. This is why sexual life can be so fraught and unpredictable and strange and joyous, or alternatively, this is why we call it love. The failure of drives to fulfill themselves, we could say, is how and why feelings come into being. We may activate our aggressive drive only to fail to get the justice or revenge that we want, or we may get what we want and discover it wasn't really what we wanted. In such instances, our aggressive impulses might be spent or smothered, but our anger remains, eating away at us from the inside. It's worth recalling, at this point, Antonio Damasio's distinction between emotions and feelings. Following Darwin, Damasio defines emotion as the way an organism instinctively and unconsciously seeks to ensure its own preservation. On this definition, emotions are those reflexive reactions that occur without our having to think about them. The disgust we feel on walking past a bin full of rotting food waste. Our delight as we scan the display cases of our favourite patisserie. But feelings involve mapping these reactions, producing images of and ideas about them. Feelings process creatively what emotions react to automatically, facilitating the possibility of creating novel, non-stereotypical responses. Anger, from this perspective, is of a higher order than aggression, a transformation of reactive behaviour into a kind of self-reflection. The psychoanalyst Hans Löwold developed a similar insight along more clinical lines, arguing in 1971 that psychoanalytic work involves transforming incoherent instincts into experienced feelings, so that what might first present in a patient as an incoherent unconscious aggression would become, in the course of a treatment, felt anger. Darwin saw anger as a kind of expressive husk of aggression, all gestures and no action. For Löwold and Damasio, in contrast, angry feelings are less a diminished version of aggression than a move to a higher form of psychic life. Anger is a way of doing something with our aggression, of transferring it from the realm of action into the realm of feeling. Both Löwold and Damasio see this movement from impulse to feeling as a wholly positive one. For Damasio, it is the expression of the organism's teleological design, which always operates for its own maximal self-preservation. Löwold, too, has a conception of the mind as aspiring to ever higher levels of emotional self-understanding. But in our daily lives, is this transition from action to feeling always experienced as an unambiguous good? Hardly. Having to carry painful feelings without knowing what to do with them is more often a torment than an education, as the victim of bullying, lumbered with an anger he cannot convert into specific action, well knows. When Freud's beaten employee's aggressive impulses were forcibly suppressed and made to take up lodging in his mind and body, he felt only an overwhelming pressure on the nervous system, just as when my own retaliatory urges towards Pete were denied any active response, they accrued in me as a tight knot in my stomach and a scream of protest in my mind's ear. When our anger is tightly coupled with aggression, it gives us a bodily sensation and mental conviction of knowing what we're doing. Anger sharpens our sense of clarity and righteousness in taking action, whether that means a physical attack, a street protest, or a marital row. But the uncoupling of anger from aggression has the opposite effect. It deprives us of an immediate outlet for aggressive action, leaving us with an enervating pressure on our nervous system. "I'm so angry," we might say to ourselves or someone else, "I don't know what to do with myself." At this point, our anger can take us down many different paths, all of which feel, in one way or another, like diversions. It can lead us to the raw frustration of undischarged rage, or to presenting our anger in the guise of some other attitude, exaggerated politeness, over-friendliness, moroseness. It can also induce a state of repression, in which we may be quite unaware of the anger we're feeling. In such a state, anger is liable to be turned unconsciously on the self in the form of depression, self-harm, addiction, psychosomatic disorders, or even suicide. Or it can persist in the depths of the psyche until it erupts in some explosive act of violence. All these diversions and displacements of anger can take both individual and collective forms, shaping private and public life alike. What does it mean for an individual person's life to be shaped by an anger it cannot make real contact with? I'm not aware of feeling that way. This was Olive's soft-spoken refrain, frequently intoned during the first year of her 3 times weekly therapy with me. For years, it was how she responded any time I ventured she was experiencing a difficult feeling. Despair, resentment, irritability, contempt, envy, and anger, above all. 3 weeks after beginning therapy, Olive arrived about 10 minutes late to the session. Despite her efforts to retain her usual immaculate composure, I caught an intimation of distraught embarrassment somewhere around the pinched corners of her downturned mouth. "I'm so very sorry," she began, as soon as she walked in. "I was at work, trying to clear the inbox, when I suddenly saw the time and rushed here. I'm afraid I still feel a little flustered. I really am sorry." I noted she seemed quite upset, to which she agreed, before gently qualifying her agreement, a 1-2 move that had already become familiar to me. "Yes, well, I mean, I'm a little upset, because I hate to waste anyone's time. It strikes me as discourteous. I'm sure you have better things to be doing than waiting for me. It's very unlike me to lose sight of the time so carelessly." "Well, maybe you didn't much feel like coming here," I said. There was what felt like a stunned silence before she repeated, "Didn't feel much like coming here?" In a tone of hushed surprise, she assured me that she was very happy to come here, that she had, after all, started therapy of her own accord. The more I implied that her lateness might have been a signal of reluctance or resentment, the more desperate her appeal to me to believe her unalloyed willingness to be here. The exchange revealed just how distressing it was for Olive to have the faintest hint of bad feeling ascribed to her, a distress exacerbated by the barrier she'd interposed between herself and her irritation at me for suggesting it. My insinuation that she might want to scream at me or worse made her, I suspected, want to scream at me or worse, the more so because she couldn't possibly do anything of the kind. Olive was under perpetual siege from her own anger, forever beating back its movement towards the front of her consciousness. Just pointing to this predicament caused me increasingly to feel like a gleeful sadist, as though coercing her into looking head-on at something whose very existence she couldn't bear to acknowledge. But why was someone so phobic towards her own feelings seeking a psychoanalyst 3 times a week? Olive's avowed reason was her ever more debilitating migraines, which she ascribed at our first meeting to the intense stress of her job. Work-related stress is undoubtedly real, but it is also a conveniently fuzzy way of depersonalizing anxiety and unhappiness, ensuring they are imputed to purely external causes. As deputy head of a charity raising awareness of child poverty, Olive's claim on job stress was certainly credible. But it also left her own life and self entirely out of the account. As it turned out, the aim she assiduously pursued during the entire first year of our sessions was to defend this self-exclusion, to insist there was nothing in her history or her present life that contributed to her malaise, that her headaches, insomnia, and loss of appetite were all symptoms of the job's demands. Of course, she was continually exposed in her job to stories of what she called real suffering, child labour, hunger, disease, with what felt like the gentlest swipe of disdain at herself and me, and this was bound to get to her sometimes. She was only human after all. A year of work passed in this way, at the end of which Olive told me in an unmistakably apologetic tone that her migraines were getting worse. "That can't have been easy to tell me," I said, "given the amount of time and money you've invested in this work." "Oh no, not at all," she replied. "I don't think of it like that. I don't expect you to magic my headaches away. How could you?" When I asked if that wasn't why she'd come to me, she became audibly upset. "Really, I'm not upset or disappointed or anything like that. If anything, it's my fault, imagining I could get rid of migraines I've had nearly all my life by just talking." Realizing immediately that she'd somewhat diminished the therapy, she continued in a panicky tone, "I think you do a great job, really." And then she burst into tears. Negative feelings like anger arise not because we're aggressive, but because we must live at a distance from our aggression. If we always knew what we wanted and faced no obstacles in obtaining it, we would have nothing to feel angry about. Seamlessly acquiring whatever we desire We would be aggressive, acquisitive, entitled, self-assertive, but never angry. All who desire something and cannot obtain it, writes Aristotle in his Rhetoric, are prone to anger and easily excited. Anger stirs in us only when we're confronted with the limits of our power to get what we want. The first such confrontation, unfortunately, occurs more or less at birth. As the American psychoanalyst Michael Eigen puts it, rage seems built into an infant's scream. When an infant first comes into the world, he is thrown into an environment full of dissatisfactions he'd never known during his gestation. The space around him is open on all sides instead of snugly bound. His feeding can be delayed, alerting him to the physical and emotional pain of hunger. Recall Winnicott's idea that the baby manages these unexpected shocks by forging an illusion of his omnipotent control. His cries cause the breast and all the tender attentions that accompany it to magically appear. However, the baby can only develop by gradually recognizing a world outside himself, what Winnicott calls a not-me world. But this means reckoning with dissatisfaction, with the non-fulfillment of all his desires for love, pleasure, and power. At first, and for a long time, all this can make us very angry. Tantrums visit on our carers and our imperious outrage at the temerity with which they defy our demands. Something of this infantile fury stubbornly persists in us for the remainder of our days, finding a new lease of life in adolescence, continuing to lurk at the edges through the various stages of midlife before its last-ditch return in our senescent rage against the dying of the light. From the moment of birth, life can seem like a rolling bad news channel. Its chyrons flashing word of our helplessness, our dependency, and our separateness across the bottom of the screen. All these bulletins remind us that the world isn't our exclusive preserve, that it must be shared with numerous other beings, each with their own needs, desires, interests, antipathies, and hopes. Tantrums stop, or at least reduce in frequency and number, once a child realizes the limits on the power of his own aggression to effect what he wants. If he grabs a toy that isn't his, it might be wrested from his hands. If he screams for its return, it'll be withheld. And if he is docile and cooperative, it may be granted. The process of accommodating to this reality, of not getting everything we want on our own terms, takes its toll. When the drive we call aggression is thwarted in the external world, it doesn't disappear. It makes for itself a different kind of existence in the interior life of the mind and body, an existence we call anger. Anger is so commonly twinned with aggression, so readily seen as the horse to aggression's carriage, that we lose sight of how precarious and opportunistic their coupling really is. As often as not, anger swells in our stomach and snakes through our bloodstream, searching for a pathway to discharge that it fails to find. This was the insight Freud had already arrived at in 1893 with the case of the beaten employee. Deprived of any external outlet for his anger, first by his boss and then by the courts, the employee must instead bear its insupportable burden in his own mind and body. Freud generalized this insight in Civilization and Its Discontents, where he argued that the maintenance of an ordered and equitable society demands that we renounce the largest portion of our aggressive energy. In one way or another, we are all the beaten employee, denied a channel for aggressive action, and so abandoned to an anger we must keep to ourselves, occasionally discharging it in empty bursts of sound and fury, more often letting it quietly corrode our physical and psychic insides. Alternatively, anger conceals itself, sometimes undetectable even to ourselves, in the guise of some other mood. This was a practice Olive had perfected over many years, to the degree that she had no idea that this was what she was doing. The flood of tears that came unbidden that day was accompanied by a low and prolonged howl. Shockingly strange, yet perfectly apt, like an unexpected visitor whose arrival you'd been anticipating without realizing it. In the sessions that followed, Olive gave voice almost without interruption to a litany of resentments, from the ruined state of the earth to the broken state of her marriage, from the emotional injuries of her childhood to her own vanishing chances of bearing a child, all of which seemed to converge in the diffuse, radiating soreness of her head, neck, and back. She laid out these experiences less in a straight narrative line than a kind of rageful collage, in which all the layers of pain and loss overlapped and bled into one another. As I listened, I felt a sensation of blissful deflation, as though a mass of bottlenecked tension was being granted release. Only now was I aware of how my joints and muscles had been tightening in unconscious solidarity with Olive's as soon as she entered the room. Her entire life felt like it had been lived under a cloud of prohibition on all bad feelings. While she knew that therapy was meant to lift that cloud, the prospect had seemed unimaginable to her. "Don't say you're angry or upset or disgusted," she had told herself silently in sessions. "He'll only hate you." But the moment she'd broken down in the session, it came to her in a flash that she could howl and cry and that I wasn't going to scold or reject her for it. She had given a rather sketchy picture of her childhood when we'd first met. What had inhibited her from giving a more detailed account, she now told me, wasn't the bad memory she'd apologized for at the time, but the deep shame at the hate that she, her parents' only child, felt towards them. In association to this admission, she recalled walking to the park with them one summer afternoon at the age of 12 when they'd stopped at the ice cream van. I was short for my age. My hair was very long and straight. I wore an Alice band, round, tortoiseshell glasses. I love ice cream, but when my father urged me to tell the man what I wanted, I panicked. I think I'd wanted a sundae with all the trimmings, but was worried I'd be told off for being greedy. So after dithering, I said I wanted a lemonade ice lolly. The man handed it over and said, "A pretty girl is even prettier when she smiles." My mother laughed out loud and said to him, "I wouldn't hold your breath, not for our little Miss Misery Guts." I don't remember the guy's reaction, only Dad joining in the laughter, adding, "Lemon for the sourpuss." Then seeing me upset, he eye-rolled and said, "Oh dear, sensitive soul again. Take a joke, Olive, take a joke." Perhaps it was the cheap humiliation in front of a stranger which had burnt that episode into the epicenter of her memory. But the story was soon revealed as but one stitch in an intricate weave of gratuitous emotional injuries. "Ah, the big boy kicked me," her mother's grating falsetto squeal mimicking Olive's tearful report at the end of a year two school day. "Are you competing to put off as many lads as possible?" her father's quip one Friday evening as he passed Olive, 16, clad head-to-toe in regulation black, black eyeliner circled thickly round her eyes, ready to go out. "Do you always talk to him like that? My God, what a nightmare. What does he see in you?" Her father again, having overheard her and her then boyfriend, now husband, in her old bedroom, squabbling in hissing undertones. "Are you sure you want to wear that frock? It needs very slim arms to pull it off." Her mother, on the morning of her wedding day. Olive had come to perceive herself through the lens of casual hostility and derision her parents had been training on her for as long as she could remember. But the curious thing about this hostility, that as soon as she tried to raise a mirror to it, it abruptly dissolved. The moment either parent saw their aggression reflected in their daughter's tears or distress or withdrawal, they would ask her, in a tone of bewildered incredulity, what on earth she was talking about. What did we do? Could they not say anything without it causing a major incident? It isn't quite accurate to call Olive her parents' only child. There had also been a boy, stillborn, 2 years before her birth. Born into families who dismissed or derided strong feelings, her parents had no language for the depth and force of their rage and grief, no means of attuning themselves to it. The boy was never talked about. If he had a name, Olive had never heard it. They resolved instead to get on with it, put the pain behind them, try again. But the pain carried over surreptitiously into their lives as parents, forever seeking some covert avenue of expression. Derision was a rage they could express as though behind their own backs, a form of abuse they could plausibly and perhaps even sincerely deny. Not the waterworks again. Why must you be so precious? Why can't you take a joke? Why must you be such a wet blanket? Steamrolling Olive's sadness and anger was an act of desperation, a displaced violence against their own feelings. Desperate because the alternative was to bear those feelings, to let themselves surrender to them, and somewhere within themselves they had intuited that this would mean unravelling irrevocably. As long as painful feelings could be laughed at, they didn't have to be felt. this was a matter not of preference, but of survival. Unable to mourn the unlived life of their son, the storm of pain went underground, rising to the surface in their casual, disavowed attacks on their daughter. The daughter who wasn't a son, who had somehow taken up the place in their hearts meant for him. "The thing that always hurt and shocked me most," Olive remarked, 4 years into her analysis, "was the way they mocked and denigrated me for being a girl. When I discovered feminism, I thought their behaviour was misogyny, and I don't think I was exactly wrong. But perhaps if having a girl hadn't been such a constant reminder of what and who I wasn't, they wouldn't have needed to be so misogynistic." Anger is where aggression becomes a psychic rather than an external force, to be felt rather than acted out. And sometimes, when anger so exceeds what we can bear to feel, it is preferable to act out, to take refuge in disowned aggression, to ridicule a child's feelings rather than suffer one's own. Thinking negative won't get you anywhere, you know. This caution, frequently directed at Olive by her father, strikes me as a choice instance of the ways prevailing ideologies seep imperceptibly into our private relationships. An effective prohibition on the expression of anger and other negative emotions has long been in place in many different regions of our daily social life. In 1983, the sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild published The Mortgaged Heart, a now classic study of new forms of service-oriented work. Hochschild's key case study was of flight attendants, done mainly by women, which marshalled, alongside physical and cognitive labour, the burgeoning discipline of emotional labour, most commonly the demand that the customer should perceive the worker's palpable pleasure in serving them while being shielded from any intimation of her strain or discomfort. Emotional labour is no longer the preserve of customer service professionals. Online culture has made emotional labourers of us all. It isn't enough to let the world know what we do to promote our competences in carpentry or nursing or folk singing. We must display our ideal selves, disseminate a personal brand, radiating effortless success and contentment while editing out any hints of failure or unhappiness. One effect of the culture of compulsory happiness Hochschild uncovered is to drive bad feelings underground where they languish in a cloud of shame, unspeakable and unwanted. The gurus and preachers of positive thinking encourage us to see emotional negativity as a drain on dedication, productivity and cooperation, and a fatal obstacle on our path towards self-optimization. As Barbara Ehrenreich memorably showed in her 2009 book Smile or Die, the gospel of positivity spread by a proliferation of self-help books and motivational speakers doesn't counsel mere disapproval or avoidance of bad feelings and the people who have them. It enjoins us to cast them out of our lives. "Get rid of negative people in your life," commands one business coach, quoted by Ehrenreich. "Negative people suck," proclaims another. "They suck the energy out of positive people like you and me. Avoid them at all cost. Trust me, you're better off without them." Others' bad feelings arouse the annihilating rage of the positive thinker, perhaps because they remind them that such feelings exist, along with the world which gives rise to them, which includes themselves. The result is a burst of unbound negativity, unencumbered by irony or self-awareness. We might imagine the positive thinker would encourage followers to pity or pep-talk negative types rather than ruthlessly expel them. But the predicament is spelt out in the words of the gurus and coaches. A negative person's bad feelings will suck the energy out of positive people like you and me. The negative person is both parasitic and infectious, such that in trying to make them more positive, you may find instead that they make you more negative. The positivity guru's zero-tolerance response to anger makes for an interesting contrast with the more moderate, managerial stance of modern psychology, which implies that anger can be controlled and kept within bounds. Unlike the advocate for total positivity, for whom all internal and external pathways to anger should be blocked off, most mainstream anger management therapies and books begin by acknowledging the universality and the inevitability of angry feelings. Their emphasis is instead on how to ensure that those feelings are kept under control by employing a range of practical techniques. These might include breathing, relaxation, exercise, creative activity, cognitive restructuring, moderating the language we use in talking to both ourselves and others, diffusing a situation with humour, silly rather than harsh, and avoiding known triggers. All these techniques are directed towards bringing anger under the command of a sovereign and reasonable self. A mainstream psychologist today is likely to allow that daily life is bound to stir up occasional angry feelings, sometimes justifiably so. Our task at the onset of such feelings is to call up the resources of logic and moderation to overcome them. Logic defeats anger because anger, even when it's justified, can quickly become irrational, states an article on the American Psychological Association, APA, website. Anger management is premised on anger's liability to distort reality, to turn minor slights, inconveniences and irritations into wounds and catastrophes. To manage our anger is to reassert the hierarchy of the rational cognitive mode over its irrational emotional counterpart, to recover our perception of things as they really are. The difference between the sober moderacy of the anger management therapist and the stridency of the positive thinking coach is essentially quantitative. The former acknowledges that we all experience some measure of anger and should seek to minimize it, while the latter outlaws anger altogether as a toxic force. Of the two, surely the anger management approach, allowing for anger as an inevitable feature of everyday life, is both the more accurate and more humane. And in encouraging us to marshal our powers of cognition against the overbearing force of emotion, it places us on the side of reason and common sense, an impression amplified by the eminently clear and measured tone and language used by the APA. In contrast, Ehrenreich's coaches and gurus, with their injunctions to get rid of negative people, would seem severely lacking in both realism and empathy. Snake oil merchants peddling the fantasy of a world expunged of all bad feelings. So, why do I find myself feeling that the anger managers miss an essential, if not the essential, point about anger to which the positive thinkers, in spite or even because of the brutality and clumsiness of their thinking, are more attuned? In the irrationality of their repudiation of anger, the preachers of positivity show us what anger does to us. In fact, the anger management approach is just as self-contradictory as the positive thinking one, less glaringly so perhaps, but more profoundly. It counsels a shift into cognitive clarity at the very moment we're possessed by the strength of our feelings. How can we assume this stance of reason if anger is, according to the very same theory, the force that corrodes and undoes reason? Logic defeats anger because anger can quickly become irrational, say the anger managers. But is it not oddly, irrationally, presumptuous to assume that logic ensures the defeat of irrationality? We might amplify the point by recalling that we live in a world in which millions of ordinary citizens ally themselves to a movement organized around the belief that the US government is being run by a secret cabal of satanistic paedophiles. While the largest proportion of global political and industrial leaders are ignoring, if not actively accelerating, the collapse of the planet's basic biological and social ecologies. In this context, it is hard not to hear the appeal to logic as itself a kind of madness. The positive thinkers are themselves tethered to a different denial of the reality of grief, anxiety, anger, and their underlying causes. But their insistence on anger as dangerously infectious, corrosive, and self-perpetuating gets much closer to the experiential marrow of angry feelings, especially as they manifest in our own moment. Take a particularly charged tableau of this present-day anger. A small band of Just Stop Oil protesters form a line directly in front of a dense, three-lane flow of road traffic, bringing it to a sudden halt. The weather is hot. Boxed into their near-stationary cars, scorched by the sun, the skin and tempers of the motorists start to overheat. The protesters walk at a provokingly stately pace, as though leading a funeral march. The motorists react with their own spontaneous coordinated action, leaning on their horns in unison, producing a screaming atonal dirge that perfectly soundtracks the scene. Until one motorist in an orange vest exits its van and starts shoving protesters hard, grabbing their banners, throwing one young man to the ground and kicking him before being ushered back to his vehicle by a woman with no obvious affiliation to either party. YouTube is replete with videos of such scenes, as though eruptions of public rage are a new kind of pornography. And watching them induces something of the same enervated compulsion, a fascination for the sheer strangeness of the conflict. We are witnessing a confrontation of two bodies of rage occupying two different regions of time. The protesters come as though from the future, grieving the demise of life on Earth as though it has already occurred, turning the urgent flow of traffic into a zombie crawl, evoking those post-apocalyptic movies in which shell-shocked survivors stumble across the scorched plains of a dead planet. The expression of their rage is muted not only for tactical reasons, but because it is aroused by what the philosopher Timothy Morton calls a hyper-object, an entity scattered everywhere and nowhere, encompassing all earthly life, both what life is and what it does. How are we to get angry at a hyper-object? No one can locate it in space or time because it cannot be apprehended in a single place or event. As Morton has it, every turn of a key in the ignition is statistically meaningless, and yet billions of things such as key turnings in ignitions are exactly what is causing global warming and mass extinction. If the protesters are thinking and acting in a time and space beyond the present, the motorists are entirely in the grip of the now, the heat, the forced immobility, the abrupt incursion into the flow of their daily lives, all press on their nerves. The sheer immediacy of this pressure concentrates their attention entirely in this moment. They do not see the far distant fossil fuel and governmental and financial interests blocking their way, the billions of key turnings. They see only a ragged line of random men and women walking at a speed calculated to infuriate them. But perhaps this inference of the motorists' feelings is too simplistic. It's hard to imagine that some, a few at least, even as they press furiously on their horns, don't somewhere intuit the deep irony of their predicament, the pounding heat, the system breakdown, the helplessness in the face of some intrusive force about which they can do nothing. Are they enraged at the protesters giving them the smallest taste of the future awaiting them? There are few acts more human than shooting the messenger. Unable to address the real object of our anger, we lash out at whatever or whoever evokes it for us, in this case the bearers of bad news, blocking the sightline to prosperity and success. Can the anger managers help with the provoking anger of the protesters and the answering rage of the motorists? There may be a social and political chasm dividing them, but in some peculiar way they are united, as we all are, by living, as Greta Thunberg puts it, in a house that's on fire. Given which, perhaps the two sides can agree on one thing, there could be no madder response to this scene than an appeal to logic and moderation. There may be another point on which they converge. Neither will enjoy the satisfaction of an aggressive action that realizes and thus dissolves their rage. The protesters know that as long as the horns are blaring and the drivers are ranting, blocking their ears to the one alarm they need to hear, they will need to continue to trudge slowly along the road, drawing hatred along the way. The motorists know that their righteous cries of "How dare you?" and "What gives you the right?", like their flailing shoves and punches, will do nothing to ease the congestion or assuage the inexorably rising temperatures within and without. Positive thinking can seem like a distinctly modern confection, a way of spreading the demands of emotional labour across the whole of society, ensuring that the forced smiles of hostile flight attendants are eventually worn by us all. One of the most striking symptoms of this spreading demand is the popular revival of the ancient Roman philosophical tradition of Stoicism. A quick Google search will turn up dozens of books, podcasts, and online courses promoting Stoic wisdom as the ideal remedy for the stress and chaos of modern life. Daily life in our modern time stirs up insupportable levels of emotional stress and enervation emanating from multiple sources: the cost of living, overwork, global unrest, the perpetual distractions of consumerism, social media's constant stoking of anxiety, envy, and outrage, the insinuation of violence and division into mainstream politics, and underlying all of these, the increasingly audible murmur of ecological breakdown. As our feelings are impelled ever more towards the furthest extremes, it is easy to see the appeal of a way of life based around management and moderation of strong emotion. In this regard, Stoicism is especially censorious towards anger, which it routinely castigates as at once the most destructive and the most futile of all feelings. The primary text for this repudiation of anger is De Ira, on anger, by the Roman philosopher Seneca, written around 45 CE. Extracts from Seneca's essay were recently retranslated and republished as one in a series of books adapting ancient wisdom to the practical problems in modern life, under the title How to Keep Your Cool, An Ancient Guide to Anger Management. De Ira is a kind of manifesto for maximal emotional labour. Its key practical counsel is that we should always, under all circumstances, suppress our anger. This is a matter not only of how we feel inside, but how we appear to the world. Seneca's startlingly vivid portraits of states of rage anticipate Darwin's view of emotional expression as a palimpsest of action. Their eyes blaze and sparkle, Seneca writes in the book's opening aphorism of men, and only men, possessed by anger. Their whole face is a deep red with the blood which boils up from the bottom of their heart. Their lips quiver, their teeth are set, their breath is laboured and hissing. They groan, bellow, and burst into scarcely intelligible talk. Their whole body is highly strung and plays those tricks which mark a distraught mind, so as to furnish an ugly and shocking picture of self-perversion and excitement. This is a body in the throes of what we would today call fight mode, dangerously excited and pressing urgently to discharge its tightly coiled aggressive energies. Seneca put weight on the appearance of anger because he places it in dangerous proximity to its conversion to violent aggression. Under Seneca's gaze, an angry comportment is already a kind of violence. In it can be seen and heard the ugly and shocking act it will become. It's for this reason that, as his essay ends, Seneca implores us not merely to avoid acting on our anger, but to eliminate all signs of it, to give away no hint of our irate mood. His point is that once our face betrays us, we have betrayed ourselves, handing over to anger the mastery of our inner self. Let it rather be locked in the innermost recesses of our breast, he counsels, and be borne by us, not bear us. Indeed, given that our inward thoughts gradually become influenced by our outward demeanour, we should use the occasion of our anger to present the mildest and most composed possible version of ourselves. Reading this passage, I'm reminded of the first year of my work with Olive, who seemed intuitively to share Seneca's view of the perilous closeness of feelings of anger to acts of violence. Whenever her husband seemed to catch some hint of displeasure or irritation in her expression, he would say something like, "What's up with you?" And she would freeze, breathless with panic, before calling up every last vestige of her will to smile brightly and say, "Nothing." After telling me of one such instance on a Monday morning, I wondered if she had any sense of why he'd asked the question. Knitting her brow, she said that he'd told her he'd invited friends for dinner for the following evening without consulting her. "So, he'd seen how unhappy you were about this." "But I wasn't. I wasn't unhappy. It's fine. It's Jeff's home. He can invite people. It's just he often does it at short notice without telling me, and I happen to have a report to finish on Sunday night, so it's bad timing. And he tends to expect me to cook and say something like, 'I would do it, but you know how terrible I am in the kitchen,' and then he'll go on to say, 'Just make some spaghetti or something.' But if he was really happy to serve spaghetti, he really could do it himself. So when he says that, I tend to think he's saying the opposite." Then after a deep sigh, "But it's fine." I asked her why, if it was all so fine, she had been so panicked when he asked what was up. "Because, obviously, I hate the idea that he'd think I'd be angry with him. He even apologised to me later because he should have asked me first, and I said to him, 'No, not at all. It was fine.'" She looked at me with a rictus smile that clearly concealed a grimace. "You're teasing me." I paused. "You're right. I suppose I was. I wonder how that makes you feel." She looked away from me, then laughed nervously. "Well, I'd better not say fine." I said it must be exhausting, always pressing down the lid on her anger. She asked me what the alternative was. Punch him? Scream in his face? Smash up all the crockery, hurl myself to the floor and beat it with my fists? Should I tell you to F off for laughing at me and slam the door on my way out? Perhaps, muses Seneca, we should paint anger as a woman, most frightful to behold. Her eyes glowing with fire, her voice hissing, roaring, grating, and making worse sounds, if worse there be, while she brandishes weapons in both hands, for she cares not to protect herself, gloomy, stained with blood, covered with scars, and livid with her own blows, reeling like a maniac, wrapped in a thick cloud, dashing hither and thither, spreading desolation and panic, loathed by everyone and by herself above all, willing, if otherwise she cannot hurt her foe, to overthrow alike earth, sea, and heaven, harmful and hateful at the same time. In this view, merely to feel angry is to launch oneself on the path towards the most extravagantly excessive violence. The figure of anger is stained with the blood she spills, as though an angry look, a furious shout, is not the prelude to a blow of the sword, but the very blow itself. It was a version of this woman, less lurid in appearance, but no less harmful or hateful, whom Olive seemed to see reflected in the face or voice of the other the moment she felt herself betraying the smallest stirring of anger. Perhaps in no thinker other than Seneca is anger so tightly coupled with aggression. But in his view, anger is very much the worse of the pair, the emotional fuel that infuses aggression with gratuitous cruelty, sadistic pleasure, and florid rage. This is the inverse of a contemporary perspective like Antonio Damasio's, for whom anger is an evolutionary and developmental achievement, a movement from behavioural reflex to feeling experience. Senecan anger is a fall into unbound violence, extinguishing all measure and every boundary, and ultimately reason itself. And yet, very near the beginning of De Ira, he concedes that anger is an emotion that can be ascribed to human beings alone. For, while anger is the foe of reason, it nevertheless does not arise in any place where reason cannot dwell. The problem is that Seneca fails to extract the proper insight from this concession, namely that anger is less the other of reason than a possibility within it. Anger, as we've seen, can certainly be marshalled by individuals and groups as a support for violence and aggression, but it is also distinct from them. As a psychic rather than an external entity, it represents the possibility of feeling rather than acting. If it can impel the movement of aggression, it can also slow, halt, reverse, or divert it. Olive, it seemed to me, had come to psychotherapy in part because she was struggling with the Senecan relationship she had long ago forged with her anger. She had learned to see her anger as a sign and seal of her own hatefulness, to fear it as the incubator of a destructiveness that would damage others and undo herself if she released it into the world. As she spoke aloud these violent scenes of punching her husband and slamming the door on me, she entered into a feeling of intimacy with her anger that was very different from acting on it, an imaginative rather than action-oriented way of working through it. This is the possibility Seneca must deny if he's to sustain his view of anger as a kind of psychopathic handmaiden to excessive cruelty. One of the paradoxes of De Ira is that while it treats feelings as near identical with action, its rendition of anger is so emotionally vivid, conveying a profound immersion in its psychic and bodily reality. It reads not merely as a treatise on anger, but as a report from the inside of it, its descriptive rhetoric brimming with the violence it wants to impugn. Seneca arrives at the imperative to suppress our anger by taking us through its most thrilling and dangerous hinterlands. The anger Seneca enjoins his readers to suppress is explicitly the privilege of Rome's ruling classes. It is exclusively to the rage of the slave owners, judges, and governors that he addresses himself, as though the fury of slaves, women, and ordinary citizens was too insignificant to warrant recognition or acknowledgement. It is precisely because the high-born man's anger is endowed with objective weight and force that he must renounce it, not to place himself on an equal footing with his inferiors, but to remain worthy of the dignity endowed by his birth. Reading Hochschild's study of mostly female flight attendants alongside Seneca, we see just how firmly this hierarchy of entitlement remains in place, even as the division of emotional labour is reversed. The lower the status, she writes, The less acceptable is the expression of open anger. The attendants are required to receive the rudeness and aggression of passengers with a smiling equanimity that belies the frustration and outrage stirring invisibly within. Answers to the question of what they want to do when they get angry include cuss, want to hit a passenger, yell in a bucket, cry, eat. The sequence of actions turns the attendant's aggression increasingly from the offender to themselves. If you think about the other person, their instructor tells them, and why they're so upset, you've taken attention off yourself and your own frustration, and you won't feel so angry. The ultimate aim of emotional labour is the effacement of the feeling self, such that anger is not only unexpressed, but imperceptible to its object. In a collective implementation of the Senecan trick, let us replace all its, anger's, symptoms by their opposites. Corporate customer service is founded on this demanding work of emotional disguise, in which feeling is exchanged for wages. The exhibition of the wrong feelings is liable today to get you deprived of welfare benefits as well as fired from your job. In 2014, notes William Davis, the UK government made attendance at cognitive behavioural therapy, CBT sessions, mandatory for some claimants of disability benefits, part of a broader push to instill a positive attitude among the non-working, especially those debilitated by depression. As popular anger over corruption, incompetence and unfairness grows, the political and business classes have a vested interest in uncoupling that anger from aggression, ensuring it doesn't mutate into social unrest or labour militancy. But the importation of positive thinking into corporate and governmental culture is about more than preventing disruption. It seeks, increasingly, to cut us off from any live contact with our anger, to render it an internal enemy, an unwanted trespasser on our emotional turf. The injunction to get rid of negative people in your life includes you above all. If you repeatedly fail to observe it, your employer and your state are liable to get very angry with you indeed. As a solution to the problem of anger, forced positivity does little to address an obvious difficulty. What are we to do with our anger if not express it directly? If we are under perpetual pressure to conceal ill feelings, is there some way they could sneak out under the radar? We are fortunate that human ingenuity has devised a surprisingly effective means for at once concealing and communicating anger, popularly known as passive aggression. Like chronic overwork or narcissistic display, passive aggression seems at some unspecified point to have become a defining symptom of our time. Passive aggression is the surreptitious, indirect, and often insidious mode in which we express antagonism or non-compliance while ensuring the plausible deniability of any such intentions. It is a key currency of both domestic life and the workplace. If it is especially effective at work, it is because passive aggression, as the code of workplace communication, has become a kind of protected behaviour. More often than not, relationships between work colleagues are suspended in a peculiar grey zone between familiarity and strangeness that breeds anxious uncertainty around the boundaries of communication. Odd remarks, too friendly, too abrupt, or too coded, break through a baseline tone of cagey, withheld politeness. In an atmosphere that tacitly discourages straightforwardness, passive aggression thrives, ever present, yet unremarked. To call out passive aggression directly would be a violation of the passive-aggressive code. Our intimate relationships tend not to enjoy such protection. Over the years, couples and families and close friends accrue a rich store of unconscious knowledge of one another's coded languages and stratagems, which makes them harder to get away with. A silence or pause, a forced smile or a stiff thank you, words and gestures that to an outsider might seem entirely innocuous or devoid of any meaning are loaded with significance for those in physical and emotional proximity. Living under an effective prohibition on the explicit expression of anger, Olive inevitably found herself having regular, if unconscious, recourse to passive aggression. Recall her abrupt freeze when her husband told her about the following evening's dinner guests. Jeff reflexively asked what was up with her because he caught sight of the fleeting, involuntary grimace that had preceded the freeze. Olive's panic was in response to the sensation of being seen and found out. Jeff knew she was angry, and she knew he knew it, and it was this mutual knowledge that must now be urgently denied. Teeth gritted and lips stiffened, the tight smile she had given him, sealing the denial, was likely the same smile she had given me when I teased her. The smile recalls the insights developed across the 1930s and 1940s of the famous, and eventually notorious, Berlin psychoanalyst Wilhelm Reich, who saw such gestures as an expression of what he called character armour, a kind of marshalling of the body's musculature in the service of a defensive blockade against feeling. Olive had recoiled in fright at the prospect of her anger being seen and felt. The function of character armour is to shield what Reich calls the effective personality, or feeling self. The ego, writes Reich, the exposed part of the personality under the continued influence of the conflict between libidinal need and threatening outer world, acquires a certain rigidity, a chronic automatically functioning mode of reaction, that which is called character. Character armour is a resonant concept for our age of enforced positivity. It is a kind of systematic restriction of our internal freedom, setting impassable barriers at the entrances to all difficult feelings. In a single moment, Olive caught her anger and confined it behind the bars of her tight smile, from where it wouldn't be allowed to escape, before it could become active. She ensured her aggression was rendered passive. As a feature of modern everyday interaction at work, in cafes and shops, on the roads, passive aggression has become the stuff of comedy, of arch lifestyle articles and social media memes. But in more intimate settings, its effect is corrosive. When Olive sensed me teasing her, she revealed many months after the event, it put her right back in her parental home, where her distress was always the occasion for a joke or a sigh of exasperation. Unable to take responsibility for the resentment they felt towards their daughter for not being their son, Olive's parents concealed their rage in the guise of teasing. The effect on Olive was what we would today call gaslighting, in particularly virulent and insidious form, her parents perpetually hinting that what she felt unmistakably as hatred was just affectionate fun, if only she could bring herself to join in. The reason intimate forms of passive aggression are so damaging is that they are so frequently unconscious. Olive's parents were very far away from conscious awareness of the contempt they showed their daughter, just as she in turn knew almost nothing of the unsettling power of those smiling denials. As her phobia of her own anger gradually decreased, Olive began to observe the ways in which her parents' style of relating had seeped into her own marriage. While Jeff never mocked her, he would repeat the same pattern of pleading innocence the moment he upset her, insisting always that he'd not intended to upset her. The last-minute dinner guests were a prime instance, an unwanted surprise infused with an aggression Jeff immediately disavowed. Olive, of course, had been all too willing to join this dance, freezing in the face of his pleas of innocence, remaining quiet, fixing her smile, and repeating that it was absolutely fine. The more insistently, the more evidently, it really wasn't. The back and forth of denials and disavowals in such standoffs are self-perpetuating. The two were equally invested in not being the one who'd provoked the other, nor the one who'd reacted angrily. And so it went on. You're angry. Me? As far as I can see, you're the one getting angry. The twisted logic of passive aggression is that it confers power not on the expression, but on the concealment of anger. It is one of the most effective forms of character armour, of shielding the vulnerability of the effective personality. If you know I'm angry, it implies I'm left dangerously undefended. The obvious value of passive-aggressive communication is that it enables the expression of anger and aggression without the attendant risk. This may be why it is so congenial to the workplace, whose accepted codes of interaction allow passive aggression to flourish. We must assume not only an attitude of politeness and cooperation, but of good faith. We cannot accuse our colleagues of nefarious or insidious motives, however much we might suspect them. Hence, the colleague reliably generous with such compliments as, "Your presentation was surprisingly good," The boss, who wonders at 5:30 if their employee might like to stay a little late this evening for the call with Australia. This is provoking or obstructive behaviour at once performed and disavowed, so that the offender can assure you that whatever you may now feel, that certainly wasn't what they meant. Whatever they have said or done to upset you, they did so with no conscious awareness or intent, leaving you to feel that you're the one with the problem. This strategy provides the perfect cover for myriad behaviours. Procrastination or forgetfulness, often with knowingly sabotaging effect, accompanied by excuses that border on accusation. You didn't say it was really urgent. Antipathy that is skillfully projected onto its object by way of doublespeak. I'm sorry if you took exception to what I said. As well as a constant yet barely perceptible attitude of sullen resentment, easily recast as just how I am. A workplace often sounds like the dissonant metallic clash of competing character armours. The issue of workplace aggression was thrust vividly into relief in April 2023, when Dominic Raab, the UK's former Deputy Prime Minister, resigned after the publication of an independent report upholding two of the complaints of former civil servants that he had behaved intimidatingly and aggressively towards them. But his resignation statement, conventionally an expression of contrition and regret, was itself aggressive. No sooner had he resigned than he launched a media offensive in which he attacked putative flaws in the inquiry and conjured up a sinister backstory to his departure. "What you've got," he told the BBC, "is the risk here of a very small minority of very activist civil servants with passive-aggressive culture of the civil service who don't like some of the reforms, whether it's Brexit, whether it's parole reform, whether it's human rights reform, effectively trying to block government." The invocation of passive aggression is notable. Firstly, in the way Raab links it to a conspiratorial narrative of secret, unaccountable state operatives sabotaging the popular will, a theme by now very familiar from Trumpian broadsides against the so-called deep state. But it is notable also for its explicit politicisation of the codes of workplace culture. Raab implies that he's been caught up in a game he can only lose because his own frank, robust and direct leadership style and the passive aggression of a cabal who retaliate quietly and invisibly, invading all accountability, and so, by implication, exacerbating his justified and considerable anger. The problem with Raab's defence is that it relies on the conspiracist mode of thinking it claims to be repudiating. The manifest case he makes is for himself as a tireless and unapologetic warrior for the popular will. He might have stopped there, arguing that his electoral mandate trumps the sensitivities of civil servants. This, as we might say, would be the argument for honest, active aggression against sneaky, passive aggression. But in a move unmistakably redolent of the Trump playbook, Raab's key message was that he's the victim here. He'd done nothing wrong, after all. On the contrary, he's the one wronged by the activist civil servants intent on obstructing his agenda, an activism the more insidious for its passivity. To add irony to paradox, in taking this line of defence, Raab falls into the classic "who, me?" pose. The startled "I didn't do anything" protest, so characteristic of the passive aggressor. Passive aggression is an exemplary illustration of the aggressive drive's essential flexibility and wiliness. If it can't find satisfaction through the direct route, it will find an indirect one through which it can assert itself more surreptitiously and so evade detection. Olive couldn't bring herself to tell Jeff she was angry or even to acknowledge the fact to herself. But her unconscious devised a way of bypassing her conscious intent and giving disguised expression to her irritation. Andre Green's passivation, describing the psychic and bodily state clinical psychoanalysis presses on the patient, is the capacity to give oneself over to the analytic situation in which the patient typically lies on a couch under the gaze of the analyst sitting behind her. The patient enters a session without the support of an agenda, ready to follow and give voice to the unpredictable flows and diversions of her mind. Having spent many years in analysis as part of my training, I know this experience from the inside. I see myself walking across the room to the analytic couch for the first time, staring at the ceiling and registering the atmosphere of silent expectation, feeling a sudden contraction of the muscles, as though my body were seeking to withhold the openness I was now supposed to yield, to protect me from a total and painful self-exposure. In that moment, speaking felt like a risky surrender, as though I was under compulsion to give up my right to silence, to entrust the contents of my mind to a man I had no particular reason to trust. I was surprised to feel a twinge of anger lurking under the surface of my anxiety, a kind of protest against the feeling of powerlessness aroused by my recumbent position, by the demand to speak, by the wish to shout at the analyst, "What do you want from me?" It's hard for me to imagine a more vivid experience of the uncoupling of anger from aggression. The analytic situation removes both patient and analyst from the external world in which they act and intervene, asking them to inhabit a purely psychic reality for the hour. It requires the patient to bear bad feelings instead of discharging them in action. Passive aggression is one way we can quietly refuse that requirement, a route to power over the other in the guise of saying or doing very little to them. The capacity to bear our own feelings is an always incomplete achievement, forever being wrested from our resistance to it, from the impulse to deny and hold back one's own vulnerability. Psychoanalysis is just one of the many kinds of love relationship in which we might find ourselves at once surrendering to and refusing the care of another. Anger, as we've seen, is perpetually frustrated or diverted from achieving its aims. Nowhere do we see this tendency more painfully borne out than in regard to the climate emergency. Why does the prospect of impending ecological collapse seem to engender so much frustrated impotence and relatively little effective anger? Few writers in recent years have raised this question with more urgency and force than Andreas Malm in his 2021 book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. Indeed, he pushes the question further, asking why it is that the climate justice movement remains so determinedly pacific in the face of ecological collapse. Confronted by the brazen daily violence of fossil capital, why are we squeamish of anything even resembling a commensurate response, like the various acts of écotage he enjoins against SUVs, pipelines, or any of the property and infrastructure accelerating planetary breakdown? The problem this raises seems to me to have less to do with the ethical and strategic knots of violent against non-violent protest, and more with the complex relationship between the feelings elicited by climate change and the action, and indeed inaction, it fuels. What, for so many of us, and certainly for me, obstructs or obscures the passage from anger to effective action? Why is the anger we feel in the face of the climate emergency so often coloured by a sense of impotence or melancholy? At the climax of his book, Malm describes what it feels like to have successfully traversed this passage from feeling to action. He had been a participant in an action by the German civil disobedience movement Ende Gelände against the Schwarzpumpe, an enormous power station in the east running on lignite or brown coal. Having blockaded the plant, the activists spontaneously resolved to break in. They pulled down the surrounding fences and roamed the area before being beaten back by the police. The following morning, the energy corporation Vattenfall announced the suspension of electricity production to the fury not only of the CEO, but of the climate-denying far-right party Alternative für Deutschland. Malm's climactic paragraph describing the feeling of this local victory is worth quoting in full. But if destroying fences was an act of violence, it was violence of the sweetest kind. I was high for weeks afterwards. All the despair that climate breakdown generates on a daily basis was out of my system, if only temporarily. I had had an injection of collective empowerment. There is a famous line in The Wretched of the Earth where Frantz Fanon writes of violence as a cleansing force. It frees the native from his despair and inaction. It makes him fearless and restores his self-respect. Few processes produce as much despair as global heating. Imagine that someday the reservoirs of that emotion built up around the world, in the global south in particular, find their outlets. There has been a time for a Gandhian climate movement, Perhaps there might come a time for a Fanonian one. The breaking offences may one day be seen as a very minor misdemeanour indeed. We are witness here to the transformation of anger from the inertial rage of despair into the effective rage of direct action. There is a distinctive utopian undertow to this passage, which derives from the sense of an ideal convergence of feeling and action, a disappearance without remainder of the one into the other, which he calls, after Fanon, a cleansing force. The passage is a telling crystallization of Malm's case for a violent flank of the mainstream climate justice movement. Violence, on his account, raises lumpen, shapeless rage to a higher level emotional state, in which the self is purified of fear and self-doubt. The invocation of the Algerian psychiatrist and political theorist Fanon, of course, places us in a particular psychoanalytic territory, a kind of psychopathology of everyday rage and despair. From Malm's Fanonian perspective, despair is an unbearable accretion of tension, denied an outlet in the external world, and so forced to remain bottlenecked inside the tight confines of the mind and body. This tension is a sign, from a psychoanalytic perspective, that the aggressive drive has been aroused, that is, the drive that seeks sovereignty over its external environment. Malm celebrates an ecstatic release of those aggressive drive energies from the claustrophobic cell of despair. But enraged despair won't always be redeemed in this way, as Freud saw very early on. Let us recall once more the failed rage of the beaten employee and those spontaneous hysterical attacks in which he falls into frenzies of silent fury. Under hypnosis, he reveals that he's been living through the scene in which his employer had abused him in the street and hit him with a stick, and then, a few days later, he tells of a second attack, during which he mimes the event that had triggered his illness, the scene in the law court when he failed to obtain satisfaction for his maltreatment. The case strikes me as at once anachronistic, hysterical attacks, bosses taking sticks to their employees in public, and replete with contemporary resonance. It captures something of the strangulated fury and voicelessness so many of us feel in the face of the continued and brazen corporate and state destruction of the earth. It's also a kind of mirror image to Malm's self-portrait in a state of triumphal release. Instead of the bent posture of despair flowering into the upright alertness of effective action, the beaten employee is as though sunk in the mire of his humiliation, a feeling which only redoubles when he tries to find redress for it. To use a well-known phrase from Freud's theory of the drives, Malm describes a soldering of rage to violence, which induces a bodily sensation and emotional conviction of knowing just what he's doing, a sharpened sense of clarity and righteousness. The hysterical pantomime of Freud's failed seeker after justice, on the other hand, depicts the radical uncoupling of anger from aggression. This uncoupling deprives us of an immediate outlet for aggressive action, leaving us with an enervating pressure on our nervous system, an anger stranded with no place to go. How do we understand this pressure in the context of the climate emergency? The question sends us back once more to Malm's book, more specifically to his account of the historical lineage of the climate justice movement, the struggles against slavery, colonialism and apartheid, and for women's suffrage and black civil rights. Each of these struggles has undoubtedly aroused profound anger and despair towards overwhelmingly oppressive avatars of power, whether imperialist nations, legal and economic systems, terrorizing mobs, or the police and judiciary. And each has at some point had recourse to methods of violent resistance, to those figurative or literal explosions of cleansing violence that redeem the despair of the oppressed. Malm sees climate justice as fully continuous with these earlier movements, and underplays, even disparages, any arguments for a basic discontinuity with them. Fossil fuel capital, in his view, is a purveyor of structural injustice on much the same lines as a colonial occupation or a racist legal system. The despair and anger it provokes need to be harnessed and discharged in aggressive action against its physical locations, in much the same way that, say, Nelson Mandela, as head of the ANC's armed wing MK, or Spear of the Nation, coordinated attacks on apartheid South Africa's military, energy, communications, and transport infrastructure. So why should we argue that the climate emergency is any different? Perhaps, on the contrary, the universality and critical urgency of the threat it presents only amplify the call for a commensurate anger to be realized in appropriately forceful action. Why should climate action be deprived of the tools of resistance previously employed against race or gender-based oppression? The question returns us to Sloterdijk's Rage and Time and his case for the thymos, or rage, of Greek philosophy and poetry as a kind of primary energy, undeducible, like the storm and the sunlight. Rage, he posits, has been an elemental force in the unfolding and shaping of human experience. Viewed through the lens of thymos, the history of modernity is the history of the ongoing struggle to produce and preserve rage as a motor of revolution and resistance. More than any other collective mood, rage is cultivated by political movements as an ongoing project, a treasure trove for its possessor. To harness and direct popular rage is to subject it to a transformation in form and shape. Rage undergoes a metamorphosis from a blind form of expenditure in the here and now to a far-sighted, world-historical project of revolution for those who have been humiliated and offended. There is more than a hint of Marm's Fanonian transition from the bent humiliation of despair to the upright empowerment of self-respect here. All history, writes Sloterdijk in his signature tone of playful provocateur, is the history of rage applications, or what we might more commonly know as wars and revolutions. Revolutionary action is that optimal moment when affect and drive, or feeling and action, unfold in perfect harmony, such that feeling fuels action in the exact degree that action realizes feeling. For this to occur, dispersed local currents of anger must be banked, deposited in a single bank of rage that draws its force from an excess of energy that longs for release. The bank of rage holds the accounts of a mass of beaten employees, concentrating in one place all the injuries and humiliations of generations of the oppressed, which are thereby transformed into an active mass of value and energy. Is this not the mass and value of energy being channeled by Marm in his climactic self-description? Does he not evoke the same liberation of stored rage in a single cathartic instance? Sloterdijk contrasts this concerted gathering and release, in which rage and action are seamlessly coupled, with a contemporary condition in which rage is instead chronically dispersed, a state of organized weakness, lacking any unifying idea. Referring to the Parisian Banlieue riots of 2005, he observes that none of the political parties could, nor wanted, to offer itself as gatherer or transformer of the emergent dirty energies. Sloterdijk here casts into relief the anomalous quality of Marm's moment of redemptive exhilaration, in which he presents himself as a kind of gatherer, concentrating the energies of a collective actor in his own person by means of action against a discrete target, the Schwarze Pumpe, which becomes the synecdoche of fossil capital, which itself is a synecdoche of ecological destruction. I'm aware that I'm placing what may seem an unfair burden of significance on this paragraph of Marm's. I'm doing so because it crystallizes for me the crucial question of what style of protest the climate emergency calls for. Marm's subjectivity of protest employs a distinctly romantic language of inspiration and self-affirmation, of the collective breathing through every individual. This kind of subjectivity implies a perfect harmony of affect and aim, of rageful feeling and aggressive action. But I'm doubtful this attitude accords with the experience of most of us confronting the climate emergency. Currents of anger and despair no doubt course through us all, but there is no single party or bank in which to deposit them. For many of us, our protests and actions, like our efforts to change daily behaviours, are scattered, confused, anxious, inconsistent. The gnawing awareness that we're not doing enough is conditioned by our sense of the sheer magnitude of what must be done. Anger is best placed to realise itself in effective action when it can drive itself in a purpose-built vehicle towards its object. The historical struggles against slavery, colonialism and apartheid, for women's suffrage and civil rights, for all the unimaginable scale of the oppressive forces confronting them, were each bounded by localized historical situations, geographical territories, and determinate aims, for slavery to end, for women to obtain the vote, and so on. The aim of the climate justice movement to keep global heating to the lowest level possible requires the intricate coordination of multiple aims, implicating the global population in action both with and against nation states, international scientific and political organizations, agricultural, transport and energy corporations, and financial institutions. Once again, we are describing not so much an object as what Timothy Morton calls a hyper-object, an entity on such a colossal and intricate scale it resists all mapping or apprehension. If climate anger has an object, in other words, it is sublimely diffuse, scattered everywhere and nowhere. Even if we reduce that object to the single component of fossil capital, we are still talking about a fiendishly complex network of forces traversing physical, financial, and political modes of despoliation, exploitation, and corruption. Forces which implicate all of us, especially in the global north, even as we protest against them. And as George Monbiot and many others have noted, fossil capital is far from being the sole driver of planetary systems collapse. Food production alone, Monbiot has pointed out, would on current models bust the entire carbon budget two or three times over if we want to avoid more than 1.5 degrees C of global heating. This is to say nothing of the soil degradation, fresh water depletion, ocean dysbiosis, habitat destruction, pesticides, and other synthetic chemicals. The labyrinthine complexity and hydra-headed persistence of the forces driving the climate emergency are liable to arouse a mirroring form of rage, a rage many of us feel as unsupportable, that struggles to find adequate representation in any given protest or action. Under such conditions, anger can become melancholic, mired in its own impotent despair. What can psychoanalysis tell us about this melancholic despair? The concept of the drive casts us as creatures destined to dissatisfaction. The drive sets in train a quest for a fulfillment that is never fully achieved. Something in the nature of the sexual drive itself, writes Freud, is unfavourable to the realisation of complete satisfaction. And no doubt the same is true of its counterpart, the aggressive drive. As we've seen, anger is what we feel at the moment satisfaction fails us. Winnicott, we recall, suggests that in the first months of life, a mother nurtures her baby's illusion of omnipotent control over the world. Ill-equipped to receive and process the news of her helplessness, dependency and separateness, the baby cooks up a scheme to deny it and tell herself an entirely different story composed of alternative facts. And because this baby's aversion to reality persists in us, as adults we continue to find ways to remake the reality around us. We may not do this in the gross form of active denialism, conspiracy theorizing, and willfully excessive levels of carbon consumption, but many of us do so in more surreptitious ways, postponing both the individual modifications necessary to reduce carbon consumption and active involvement in the collective movement for climate justice. Because carbon consumption is woven so intricately into the fabric of our daily lives, in the ways we eat and heat and move and enjoy ourselves, we, like Winnicott's baby, excise and overwrite the bad news of our interdependency with the systems whose breakdown we're helping to accelerate. It could be said that in the historical struggles that preceded climate change, there were unambiguously just victories over unambiguously unjust ruling powers. In the struggle for climate justice, it is difficult to set two sides apart so cleanly. We can distinguish the state and corporate drivers of global heating from the rest of us, but as soon as we look closely at the issue, we become aware that those entities draw the rest of us into the same destructive political, economic and cultural circuits. Our rage at the inertia, cynicism and venality of politics and business is at once intensified and deadened by the ways the political and business classes implicate us in crimes against ourselves, as well as everyone and everything else. Another simpler way of putting this is that no one, not even the corporate leaders of Shell, BP, Aramco and the rest, will benefit from the heating of the planet. None of us is shielded from the responsibility for the emergency, nor from its calamitous effects. This strikes me as another way Malm simplifies the subjectivity of climate protest and action. At one point in How to Blow Up a Pipeline, he disparages an XR banner from a London street protest reading, "Police, we love you, it's for your children too," as an expression of misplaced obsequiousness, ignoring the role of the police in the brutal suppression of climate activism. The point of the banner, at least as I read it, is not to greenwash the police, but to remind the police that they will die with the rest of us, that the climate emergency, unlike apartheid or sexism, benefits no one. As global heating hits 2, then 4 degrees and beyond, even the oil companies and their executives, having inexorably killed off their customer base, will die off soon enough. None of this is to ignore the profound inequities between North and South, or between rich and poor, everywhere in the distribution of the malign effects of climate change. But as temperatures rise, the wealthy will be consigned to what we might call worldless lives, artificial bubbles of precarious survival at best. There is no meaningful incentive, even of the most callously self-interested kind, to keep heating the world. Cui bono? Who benefits? Ernst Toller, the pastor at the centre of Paul Schrader's 2017 film First Reformed, puts the question to his diary, following his exchanges with anguished climate activist Michael Mensana. This surname, Healthy Mind, of a broken melancholic readying himself for suicidal violence, is one of the film's many deliberate ambiguities. Toller meets with Mensana at the request of the latter's wife Mary, who is 20 weeks pregnant. Michael is an antinatalist who's urged her to terminate, telling Toller he can't justify bringing a new life into an unlivable world. Toller ends up a little like the pastor in Freud's famous joke, who is called on by the village atheist, an insurance broker, for a deathbed visit. At the end of a long night, the broker remains an atheist, but the pastor is fully insured. In Schrader's mirthless rewriting of this joke, it isn't insurance that's bequeathed by the man on the verge of death, because the coming crisis invalidates all policies. Instead, Mensana passes on to Toller an interminable legacy of despair, the same despair he sought to fend off for many years through drink and an increasingly threadbare theological conviction. The physical manifestation of this despair is Mensana's suicide vest, which Mary finds in his shed and hands over to Toller to dispose of. In Malm's vision, the subjectivity of resistance converts a lumpen mass of internal despair into a live and conscious anger that fuels a fearlessly targeted violence against fossil infrastructure. Mensana's despair, on the other hand, is not transformed into a different emotion, but instead intensifies to the point where it shades imperceptibly into impotent rage. When that rage is discharged as anger, it has none of the carefully calibrated harmony Malm envisions between emotion and action. Rage dispossesses him to the point where it authorizes a kind of unbound violence whose first target is the self, in which the join between righteousness and nihilism has dissolved. Toller meets Mensana in a state of aggravated melancholia arising from the loss of his son, an army chaplain, in Iraq. A former chaplain himself, like his father before him, Toller bears the terrible guilt of having encouraged his son to join up, overriding the explicit objections of his wife, and so, in his own mind, sending him to his death in a meaningless war. So when Toller, having received a text from Mensana to meet him in a local park, arrives there to find him dead in the snow, his head blown through by his own rifle, he is all too ready to receive the younger man's legacy of violent despair. Even before her pregnancy, Mary tells Toller after Mensana's suicide, he was just so full of anger. Unaware, she says this, that she's speaking to a man similarly ravaged by his own rage. As the new recipient of Mensana's suicidally rageful legacy, Toller, writing to his diary in the dead of night, asks the question, cui bono? Who benefits? The phrase belongs to Lucius Cassius, a Roman politician of the 2nd century, praised by Cicero as the most honest and wisest of judges, who would never fail to ask the question when adjudicating lawsuits. The question places crime in an ideally rational perspective, assuming not only an unbroken line from motive to action, but a proportionate fit between them. If I can obtain a benefit by killing one person, there is no need to kill 10. Toller's question concerns the various natural sites in the region turned into toxic waste dumps, courtesy of Edward Bulk, a local tycoon and stationery manufacturer, whose factory was the likely target of Michael's suicide mission. The desperate exchange between Toller and Michael, and the discovery of the suicide vest, drive the film into the generic territory of the Race Against Time thriller. But the pace and composition belie this urgency, as the film unfolds in cold, static long shots, as though infected by the same melancholy as its characters. Every face, every room, every landscape is rendered with a kind of irremediable, elegiac sorrow. When Schrader's camera, the film is beautifully photographed by Alexander Dynan, lingers in eerie stillness on Hansdown Kills, the lakesite poisoned and ravaged by Balk's industries, where rusting metal, plastic, and chemical waste bleed into the waters, the image conveys depths of irreparable natural and psychic damage that seem to make a mockery of any response. A strange sequence towards the end pulls the film abruptly into hallucinatory anti-naturalism. Mary visits Toller and asks him to reenact an intimate ritual she would perform with her dead husband. She would lie on top of him, both fully clothed, pressing into each other for maximal bodily contact and facial proximity. In doing the same with Toller, Mary completes the unsettling identification of the two men. The pair levitate and are suddenly launched into the cosmos, which resolves into a series of kitschily beautiful tropical landscapes, which themselves morph into tableau of ecological horror, most memorably an unending field of scorched rubber tires. As he floats over these ruins, Toller's face is contorted with an anguish that completes his full absorption into Michael's legacy of violent despair. It's following this scene that Toller hatches his scheme to detonate Michael's suicide vest at the 250th anniversary celebration of the First Reformed Church, financed by Balk, when it will overflow with local people. Ordinary citizens will die alongside Balk, as though the climate crisis has fatally eroded the distinction between the innocent and the guilty, so that action too cannot differentiate between divine justice and a crime against humanity. Along with the church and its occupants, the vest explodes, Toller's qui bono, the question that seeks to cut an exact pathway to the guilty, as though with an Occam's razor of justice. The bomb answers the razor's precise justice with the chaotic rage that lays waste to justice. Before she moves away from Snowbridge, Mary promises to return for the anniversary. Toller implores her to stay away, but just after he's buttoned up the vest and concealed it under his cassock, and before entering the church, he spots her arriving. In horrified panic, he removes the vest and replaces it with a long string of barbed wire, which he wraps tightly around his torso, an act of self-mortification excruciating to watch. Placing his cassock over his bleeding trunk, he pours a glass of Drano drain cleaner, which he's lifting to his lips when Mary enters the room. The glass falls out of his hand, and they run to each other and kiss hungrily, ecstatically, the camera circling around them vertiginously before very abruptly cutting to black. One could almost overdose on the allegorical significance. Toller runs to Mary, the divine mother and carnal lover. Their wild embrace redirects all the energies of rageful despair into an omnivorous love as earthly as it is spiritual. Instead of being entirely discharged in violent aggression, rage realizes itself in erotic surrender. Among the easily missed quiet exchanges in First Reformed is a moment soon after Michael's suicide, in which Toller asks Mary how she felt about her husband's activism. "I share his views," she says, with an almost offhanded nod, "but those views aren't identical with the ways he or she might choose to act on them in the world." Michael renounces love in the name of a formless and infinite rage he transmits to Toller with his suicide. Only at the moment Toller's rage is about to realize itself in an act of indiscriminate violence does Mary enter the scene to offer it an alternative itinerary, an immediate and miraculous redirection into boundless love. I'm not sure this climactic delirium is anything as straightforward or sentimental as a conversion from rage to love. It seems to me something more like a strange combustion of rage in love, which keeps both feelings fully alive. Perhaps this ending affects me so powerfully because it brings to the surface what I know without knowing it. If I'm not as angry as I should be about the climate emergency, it's because somewhere I've intuited how unsupportable my anger and grief might be if I gave myself over to it fully, if I really let myself know about the precariousness of our own and our children's future. Thus far, I've done more or less nothing about this, a poor state of affairs that I'm resolved to change, partly as a consequence of writing this book. But I have needed first to try to understand why I've done nothing. Why, when I try to give anything like imaginative shape to my rage, it just doesn't feel like the apt cleansing action that restores self-respect, but more like the dispossessing chaos and disorganization the infant feels when she intuits the existence of a world beyond her control.